All right, this is podcast number 29. I am Bob Nalbandian, your host, and we got a great episode. In promotion with Martin Popoff's latest book, Judas Priest, Heavy Metal Painkillers, we're going to do a very, very special episode. We've got the great Martin Popoff, author of the book, as well as Monty Connor, the head of A&R for Roadrunner Records, on this podcast. And what we're going to do, like we did in previous episodes with Martin Popoff, if you go back to, I believe, podcast number 8, we did an interview with Martin Popoff where we went through the entire Black Sabbath catalog. We're going to do the same with Judas Priest on this episode, but we're going to have Monty Connor included in the debate. Some great, great stuff. Before we get into the debate, though, be sure to check out martinpopoff.com. You could order all his great books there, including this latest Judas Priest Heavy Metal Painkillers, available on ECW Press. It should be available in all the bookstores. Also, when you go to his site, check out his great new book series called Ye Old Metal. And for those of you unfamiliar with Monty Connor, he is the head of A&R at Roadrunner Records and is responsible for signing some of the most groundbreaking metal bands over the last 20 years, including Sepultura, Slipknot, Typo Negative, Fear Factory, Killswitch Engage, Trivium, and Machine Head. I'm also going to be featuring a great interview with Monty Connor, which will be on a separate future podcast, which will be in regard to the music business and Roadrunner Records. So for all you unsigned metal bands out there, you're definitely going to want to tune into this because Monty's going to give some great advice for all you upcoming metal bands. So with that said, we got a great extended conversation. So kick back, crack open a beer, and enjoy. Here is the great Judas Priest debate.
So we got Martin Popoff live in Toronto, Canada, and Monty Connor live in New York City at the Roadrunner Records offices, and we're going to talk about Judas Priest. How are you guys doing?
Doing fine. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, it's exciting. My first podcast.
This is actually the first time we're obviously talking with Monty Connor on the Shockwaves Hard Radio podcast. Obviously, we spoke with Martin before regarding his previous books, the Black Sabbath book, Doom Let Loose, and more recently, The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal, Volume 3. And this interview in particular is regarding Martin's brand new book on ECW, Judas Priest, Heavy Metal Painkillers. So what I figured what we'd do, as we did in the past podcast with Martin, we'll go through the whole Priest catalog, but this time around we got, of course, our third party metal expert, Mr. Monty Connor, the head of A&R at Roadrunner Records, is going to join us with this great Priest debate.
So in other words, I'm here to, like, put Martin in his place if he says anything wacky?
Exactly. Straighten me out if I'm wrong, because you definitely know your stuff.
So. Yeah, because Martin, I mean, if you start saying Ram It Down is the best Priest album, I'm definitely going to have some issues.
Well, this is good, man. I want this to be a full-on battle zone. Speak the truth. Speak whatever you want. This is a podcast, so anything goes.
The funny thing is, Martin and I will always exchange emails where we'll list a band like Deep Purple, and we'll list like our best albums from best to worst, and we always usually disagree.
Right.
Oh, we had Gillan debate, ZZ Top debate. It was great.
Exactly.
That's in particular why I think this is going to be such an interesting podcast, because all three of us have grown up kind of pretty much in the same, you know, metal likings in the past,
right,
from the beginning, but we have, you know, such different tastes. We're all huge metal fans, and the fact that you guys are very opinionated, which I think is great. So, no ass-kissing here. Let's just go balls out. But before we do get into the actual Priest catalog, I always learn so much after reading Martin's books, and I always realize how little I know about metal after reading your books, Martin. And I never realized that the original Judas Priest didn't feature any of the members that recorded on record. I always thought KK and Ian formed the band with Alan John Atkins.
Yeah, well, it's kind of cool that they are literally as old as Black Sabbath. I mean, we always think of Priest as the second-generation band and maybe Iron Maiden as the third, and then it gets a little complicated, but basically, you know, Priest's first album was five records into Black Sabbath's catalog, yet they started at the same time.
In 1969,
yeah. Yeah, it was Al Atkins who ran it, and he had totally different members, and then members just sort of, you know, showed up as they came along, and Rob Halford, I think, is sort of vintage 73 or so, and their first album 74, so yeah, it's pretty cool.
I didn't realize prior to their first recordings how much touring they did with, you know, bands like Budgie in particular, and Slade and Quo and Thin Lizzy, and this is before they even recorded, correct?
Yeah, it's really kind of cool. They did a lot of touring with Budgie, and there's stories in there about them, you know, more or less bunking together and borrowing flats and borrowing vans and things like that, but they'd been around. And of course, Glenn Tipton had that shelved studio album with the Flying Hat Band. And I think he mentions that one of his scary moments was backing up Deep Purple or somebody like that. So yeah, they'd all been around.
Yeah, I think you had mentioned in the book in the very first chapter that the Flying Hat Band got shelved because the label thought it sounded too much like Black Sabbath at the time.
Yeah, and then that leads into the catalog, because Rockarola, I mean, to my mind is, and they somewhat admit this, that it is a little bit of a Black Sabbath ripoff. You've got Roger Bain in there, I believe, as producer.
Right.
And, you know, it is quite Sabbathy. I mean, it's heavy with progressive things going on. It's got long songs, short songs, weird little songs. You know, they're both from Birmingham, that whole thing. So, I mean, Sabbath, I think, was firmly on their mind when they made that album.
Absolutely. And that, of course, was released in 1974 on the Gull label, the independent label. One thing I do want to mention, we'll talk about the albums as we viewed it when the albums first came out or when we first heard the records, as the vinyl renditions rather than the reissued catalog with all the bonus tracks. So your first feeling when you first heard the Rockarola record, Martin?
It was kind of magical for me because I bought Sad Wings as a new release. That's the second album, of course. And then I only ever bought two records mail order in my life. You know, it was just like too complicated. I bought an Aerosmith bootleg, Look Homeward Angel, and I bought Rockarola mail order. So it just, you know, flipping through one of those cool little record catalogs one day at 14 years old, finding this thing and just flipping out because there's an older Judas Priest album? This is insane, you know? So it was one of the very, very coolest purchases for me because, you know, I kept going to my mailbox just wishing that record would show up, and finally it did. And, I loved it. I mean, of course, it wasn't as good as Sad Wings, but it was a pale, dim facsimile of probably the greatest metal album since Deep Purple's In Rock, which was Sad Wings. So for a six-year gap there, you had Sad Wings, and then you had, like, the kind of crappy blueprint of it, which was still pretty good.
What about you, Monty?
Well, I agree with Martin in that there was a certain mystique to that record because, you know, I lived in Staten Island, and at the time I didn't really come into Manhattan to do record shopping because I was pretty young. But, yeah, I mean, that record was almost impossible to find, so when you did find it, and I actually did find it in a store, it was like discovering the Holy Grail. But my Priest experience started a little bit later than Martin. I first got into Priest in 1978. Hellbent for Leather was my first record. And, you know, and then I went backwards and got into Sin After Sin and Stained Class. And Sad Wings was equally hard to find. So when I first heard Rockarola, I was already, like, accustomed to the more modern sound of Priest. And I remember really, you know, obviously I didn't think it was as good as the other records at the time, but I remember being very fond about it. Whereas nowadays, you know, of course, having the benefit of looking back in history and being more mature in your tastes, now when I go back and listen to that record, I really can't get into it at all, to be honest, because, you know, to me, it just sounds like a band that hadn't yet discovered who they were. And even working here at Roadrunner, there's plenty of cases of, you know, bands like Typo Negative where they make a first record like Slow, Deep, and Hard, and it really has so little to do with a follow-up record like Bloody Kisses, or even Fear Factory, where on a second record they really kind of define who they are. And I know, of course, that sounds like a cheap plug for Roadrunner, but I'm really trying to make an example that, you know, for me, that was like kind of Priest not really having a direction yet, just, you know, as you guys touched on, being influenced by Sabbath. So looking back on it, I don't really consider it a true Priest record. For me, Priest started with Sad Wings of Destiny. That's when the modern-day Priest sound evolved.
I agree. I agree more with you, Monty. I agree that it was kind of Priest was coming to their sound, and they were kind of experimenting a bit, and they leaned heavily on the Black Sabbath sound. I don't know if it was particularly them or Roger Bain's production. I wasn't fond of the production at all. I actually got into that album a little bit later. I got into Priest pretty much Stained Class era, and then kind of went back. It was funny because I had heard about Priest, and back then everyone talked about the first album being just a poor man's Black Sabbath. I remember hearing that, and I was obviously very young when that came out, but I remember seeing that album cover a couple times and just hated it, the bottle cap, you know, with a Rockarola.
And the Coca-Cola.
Exactly. And then I remember hearing the title track, the Rock-A-Roll-A Woman for a Rock-A-Roll-A Man, and I'm just even back then going, God, this is lame. But then I got the album finally, and Never Satisfied, I love that song.
Yeah, that's a good
song.
One, and I guarantee you, had they decided to, like, do one or two songs from that record on Unleashing the East, and, like, really, like, metalized it and made it, like, more the modern Priest, I bet you it would have held up a little bit better.
I agree. That would have been
great. Take a song like Rock-A-Roll, have them do it on Unleashing the East, and it would have rocked pretty hard, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I also maintain, though, a little bit that, you know, I think it's a little harsh to say Priest started with Sad Wings, because I think if you remove that album cover and, you know, maybe change a couple of lyrics and make them a little more serious or whatever, it's pretty close to Sad Wings. I mean, it doesn't have the same fireworks, but it has that same kind of, you know, leaden vibe to it.
I agree with the production. I think for the first three albums in particular, the sound was so thin. And then, of course, on the live album, they just, I mean, that's their true sound. But I think they struggled with producers in the past, definitely.
Well, yeah, I think Sad Wings, I don't think the production on Sad Wings is really much better than Rock-A-Roll. It's still that really, you know, old school, dry, like, just dead kind of sound.
Not a lot of treble, but still, the frequencies are more or less there. It doesn't leap out at you as terrible. It's just that it sounds a little bit cardboard boxy, I guess.
Well, another thing that's, you know, and I guess we could jump into Sad Wings quickly, but,
sure.
You know, it was a similar thing on Sad Wings, is I discovered Sad Wings after I had gotten Unleashed in the East. So to me, Unleashed in the East was my first taste of those songs from Sad Wings. That's kind of what made Unleashed so special, is that at the time that record came out, Sad Wings was still impossible to find. So when I picked up Unleashed, I was hearing those Sad Wings songs for the first time. And naturally, you tend to fall in love with the way you hear something for the first time. So, you know, I love the Unleashed in the East versions, but then when I heard the studio versions of Sad Wings, they sounded so sluggish and so slow.
Totally.
It's kind of like, you know, when you're raised on Kiss Alive and you get used to those versions, then you go back to the versions on the three studio records. Like, there's no track on Kiss Alive that doesn't beat the studio counterpart. So it's the same thing for me, as having discovered Sad Wings after being into Unleashed, I don't think I was ever really able to appreciate how great Sad Wings really was at the time, because I was hearing it with the Unleashed versions in my head, and those versions just piss all over the versions on Sad Wings.
Totally.
They're just faster and so much more energetic. So I think if I would have gotten Sad Wings when it first came out, I would have worshipped it. As it turns out, since I heard it after the fact, I still totally appreciate it as a classic, but I just always yearned for the Unleashed version.
Yeah.
That was my experience. How about you, Martin?
Well, I think Sad Wings, you know, we got that record, and we were actually almost scared of it, terrified of it in a way. I mean, it literally seemed to be a little bit like Merciful Fate arriving, completely like so skillful, you're thinking these guys are in league with Satan. I mean,
yeah, the Merciful Fate comparison is a good one, definitely.
Yeah, and that record, you know, I always maintain, I mean, you fix these things in your mind, but I maintain that it is the first big Richter blip, improvement in metal, sophistication, craft, lyrics, everything since Deep Purple in Rock. I mean, between those albums, there are great things happening, but it is the first real jump up, and then maybe the next real jump up is maybe Metallica Ride the Lightning or something like that. But when we got that record, I mean, I remember buying it, not knowing anything about the band, thinking, is this Christian metal? This is a little weird. I mean, look at this guy. He's got short hair. He kind of looks like he's doing the big cross thing on the back. You know, very, very religious imagery on the front. It's almost like everything you wanted was served to you on a plate way more than you're supposed to get it. Kind of like when Iggy Pop did the Instinct album, and you're getting him finally doing a metal album, and you're not sure if it works out, or Dio giving you a concept album for the first time, and that definitely didn't work out. But here was a band, like, giving you everything you imagined you wanted from metal, like this weird new kind of singing, these riffs that, you know, if you piled up all the greatest riffs of all time, like 5 out of the top 10 are probably right here by a bunch of unknowns. It was just an amazing, amazing time where we just thought, like, we used to make lists all the time, and all of a sudden Priest was at the top of every single list.
I'm in the same boat as Monty, as I actually got to Unleashed in the East, and I went back for that. Now, it's funny, when that album came out, I had a buddy of mine, and his older brother was really into prog metal. That was one of the metal releases that he had in his catalog, and I had heard it, and I had always heard people say, oh, it's kind of a poor man's Sabbath, and I still kind of heard that. I remember liking it, but I never was able to own it because it was so hard to get. It was, again, on Gold Records. And again, you got to remember their original vocalist, Alan Atkins, wrote the majority of the songs off that and the first album, correct?
Yeah, he'll never let anyone forget it to this day either.
Exactly.
I don't know about guys who are into
But it really, I mean, after hearing it, you really could hear that they really followed Sabbath's footsteps. And I think the production was kind of weak and the same. And it just, you know, when you hear the songs live, it's like, okay, this is the way it's meant to be when you listen to Unleashed in These. But hearing those versions kind of slowed down and real just kind of soupy and just, I don't know, I just don't think the album just comes out very powerful. I think the riffs are great, but again, they lean very heavily onto Black Sabbath meets prog rock to me.
Well,
but
again, for sure, I mean, compare it to what you had in 1976, and it's an amazing record for 1976.
Oh, absolutely.
There's nothing much around it.
But after having the Unleashed version in your head, you can't listen to the studio version without them just sounding like the band's on Quaaludes, just like slowing out of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Same way you feel when you hear Kiss doing any of the songs from the first three records. They just don't have that drive. They're just very sluggish.
But you know, a lot of those bands, not only Sabbath, you know, bands like Budgie, a lot of those British bands from that era kind of had that real slow, sluggish kind of sound. Sabbath obviously was the band that made it big doing that sound, but there were actually a lot of bands at that time kind of doing that. So should we hop into Sin After Sin?
Sure, go ahead.
1977, Sin After Sin. Well, you started off there, Martin.
Well, you sure that was 77?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, 77.
1 year after, yeah.
Okay. That, to me, I mean, I think the coolest thing about this Judas Priest book is that we stuck in that ad for that, because to me that kicked it all off. Seeing that ad, I can't quite recall, I may be getting this a little wrong, but either the record just showed up in the store like a holy grail mirage of some sort, or I saw that ad, Judas Priest has Sin for Sale first, that tiny ad which might have been in Circus or Hit Parade or something at the time. But getting that album, it was a totally, totally different album. Now you had production that was more eccentric than the first two. You had a definitely thin production with a lot of treble and not a lot of bass. You had a drummer on there who was a crazy jazz fusion kind of drummer who did nutty things all over, like the first track and Dissident Aggressor. And way more technical, way more dynamic, complicated, smart than Sad Wings of Destiny. Way more novel in the arrangements, how many ideas they would cram into each song. But again, you know, it just affirmed what we were putting on all our lists, that these guys were like the absolute pinnacle of, you know, being way out there and way up there making like the most professional metal. I don't know if it was the stuff that hit you in the most emotional way or whatever, that almost didn't matter. This was kind of a side and saying, this is the most intellectual metal going right now.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said on that one. And, you know, the thing I think about, of course, with that record is just the album cover was so evil-looking, so brooding. You know, this was a time back in the old days when, you know, it was all about vinyl, so you'd sit there with your record player, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm sure it was the same way with you, is that the entire 45 minutes or 40 minutes that you're listening to this record, you're sitting on your bed or wherever your stereo is, and you have the cover in your hands, and you're flipping from the back to the front, and it's like all you're looking at. So I can't listen to that record without having that cover ingrained in my mind. Like, I just, the colors of that cover, everything about it is just like in my head the entire time I'm listening to the music.
Mm,
so
cool.
It just kind of adds to the whole evil vibe of the record. And of course, opening with Sinner, which is one of the all-time Priest classics. It was just a better record, pound for pound, in every way than Sad Wings. Although Sad Wings does have some of the ultimate Priest classics on it, like, you know, Victim of Changes and Tyrant and Ripper. And, you know, pound for pound, I thought maybe Sad Wings does have a few more classics. But Sin After Sin, to me, is just really where it all came together for Priest. That's, like, truly where they arrived. Like, Sad Wings was, for me, kind of where they were, you know, they finally decided who they were and had a direction. But to me, Sin After Sin is when they finally nailed that direction. And, you know, it was the best record to date, for sure.
I agree. I think they kind of came into their own sound a little bit more. Kind of, like I just say, a more sophisticated Black Sabbath. A little bit more progressive, a lot more stuff going on in there. Of course, it was their first record on CBS, a major label. They had more money behind them. I agree about the album cover. It had a certain mystique about it, both visually and musically. Now, of course, Roger Glover produced that record, which I was really disappointed, again, in the sound there. I thought, you know, apparently they were real rushed in the studio, according to your book, again, referring back to the Judas Priest Heavy Metal Painkillers book. They did record almost an entire record before Roger Glover came into the picture, right? And then they redid the whole record, and so they only had a limited budget left. Is that kind of correct there, Mark?
Well, that blows my mind, and I don't really know enough about that story. And I don't know if I go so far as to say they recorded an entire record, but they were recording, and not getting anywhere, and they had to basically switch in midstream. And the guys don't talk about it that much as well. I mean, that would be a very, very interesting story to hear from. Them. But no, I mean, I think we would have known by now if we were talking about other songs here. I don't think there are other songs.
Right, right. But again, Simon Phillips definitely adds to that record, of course, coming from a jazz background. And I think from there, you know, with the future releases, you know, with Les Binks anyway, it kind of lent to their sound with just this great guitar band with an amazing drummer. And it kind of led to the speed and the sophistication of heavy metal. And I think if it was a heavier guitar sound, it's funny because, like you say, a Sad Wings is a little bit bass heavy. This one was a lot more treble heavy. And it kind of, the lower end there, especially on songs like Dissident Aggressor and Sinner, it just could have been a lot more fuller. But, you know, again, it was, you know, back in 77 and the band were still fairly new, kind of getting their sound together. What's interesting is that was Mark Dodson that engineered that.
Oh, right.
I
guess that was him in his old days rising up through the ranks.
Exactly. So who, of course, became, you know, a huge producer in the 80s. But yeah, I agree. I think the it was definitely their best to that date. And that leads us to Stained Class, one of my favorites in 1978. Lead us off on that, Martin.
I remember getting that one, and that definitely was a case of it just the record just appearing on the shelves. And I remember focusing my eyes on that new logo and saying, what the heck does that... Does that say Judas Priest? And just freaking out because this looked like a disco album cover. There's a whole new logo. It's a modern logo. I just could not believe that, boom, just like that, here we were with a new Judas Priest record. And I remember getting that home and listening to Exciter. And, I mean, here you had production that was a little better than the last album. The songs were a little more enigmatic and personal, personable, passionate, slightly more accessible in the main, in the total. I think there's like, what, is there 9 songs on there, I believe?
Yeah.
You know, all of sort of similar lengths and all a little more conventional, but again, just fireworks all over the place. Like you say, Bob, you know, great drummer, great guitar work. Halford is extreme as all get out on that thing. And again, it's just like, third time around, here is a band that, like, nobody is coming close. I mean, all our metal greats. Deep Purple is broken up. Rainbow is morphing. They're making good but conventional rock albums. Even Scorpions are making pretty conventional albums compared to this. I mean, no one is doing anything like this. Truly, truly progressive metal. You know, interesting you mentioned progressive metal early on. I mean, of course, there really was no such thing. But Priest was the one band that was, like, you know, heavier than anything out there, really. Yet, you could still call them progressive metal, and the only other band in existence that was progressive metal was Rush. And, of course, by that point, they were nowhere near as heavy as anything Priest was doing.
Monty?
Well, I mean, to me, Stained Class was the best Priest album to date. It was like the fourth record in a row where they continued to improve. I think the production was better than Stained Class. I believe at the time, Exciter was like some of the fastest double bass going to that.
Absolutely.
So it was a pretty extreme track. It's got tons of classics. I mean, I would rate it personally in the top 3 all-time Priest records. Absolutely fantastic record. I didn't mind the cover. It looked like a metal cover to me. I didn't really get the whole disco thing Martin mentioned. But yeah, just huge, huge progress. One of the top 3 Priest records. Classic.
I agree. That's one of my favorite records, and that's when I really got into them. The funny thing, when you mentioned Rush, I remember before the record came out, or before I got the record anyway, I remember hearing Exciter was on the radio. I wouldn't say it was a hit, but very seldom you'd hear it on the radio. And I remember hearing it thinking it was Rush because no one had that extreme vocal like, you know, Rob Halford. You know, and I'm thinking it's Geddy Lee because listening back to like 2112, you know, he sang very high. And for the longest time before I got the record, I thought Exciter was a Rush song until, you know, my friend brought over the album. Because, of course, back then, you know, you had to save up your allowance to buy records. So it took a while before you could buy a record. My friend had the album, and I totally fell in love with the record. Beyond the Realms of Death, by far the greatest ballad ever written. that defined power ballad. I think that song and Love to Love by UFO were the ultimate power ballad songs, and then the name just got disgraced in the 80s with all these glam bands. But that's what I consider original ballad that just builds into just extreme heaviness. Classic, you know, again, Les Binks, one of my favorite drummers, the double bass when Exciter starts off, and just the chops he does, just amazing stuff. Production a little bit better, but still very thin. Of course, Dennis McKay, he was a big jazz producer, and he had done the Pat Travers Putting It Straight, and I think the Tigers, was it the Cage record? I think it was the Cage record. Both very clean sounding records.
Was Chris Sangarides.
Spellbound was Chris Sangarides.
Oh, he didn't carry over to that record?
No, Cage was real clean. And the thing about Dennis's production, very thin guitar, very much like jazz. The drums are very clean, but crisp drum sound. I mean, you could hear every single tom and everything so clearly. But the guitars are kind of buried. And that was kind of the only real fallback to the record. But the songs, definitely brilliant stuff. One of my favorite Priest albums.
Yeah. It's also the second Priest record to have a cover song, right? They covered Better By You, Better Than Me by Spooky Tooth.
Well, actually before they did Diamonds and Rust by
Joan
Baez.
Yeah, that was the second time they did a cover.
That's right. I forgot about that. And then, of course, Green Manalishi, which leads us to Hellbent for Leather. Why don't you kick that one off? Hellbent for Leather, February 1979, exactly 1 year after Stained Class was released.
That's definitely, without a doubt, my favorite Priest album. I remember a buddy of mine, Forrest Toop, we were the two metalheads buying all this stuff at the same time, convincing all our friends of the value of all this stuff. We were kind of the champions of the form as kids, but I remember he went on a family vacation, came back with Killing Machine, and just
which, of course, was
it.
The British title of that album.
Yeah, just loving the album. We were just blown away by it. To me, that is the perfect Priest album because it's like the cusp between the old technical stuff and a little bit of commerciality, but not very much, and that would come later kind of thing. I think it's the best production they have of the entire catalog. I think it's varied, it's sequenced well, it's got slow songs, atmospheric songs, it's got a complete ballad, it's got a commercial song, it's got probably their best heavy songs of all time, like a good three or four of those, Burning Up, Delivering the Goods, Hellbent for Leather, Running Wild, Rock Forever, right there. I mean, you know, on any given day, I could list those as my five favorite Priest songs. And then I remember, you know, just playing that album to death, but me not owning it. And then eventually, I think I went on a summer vacation or something or other and bought Hellbent for Leather with the inferior washed-out orange Judas Priest logo, but with the extra song, an amazing, amazing, super-heavy cover of Fleetwood Mac's Green Manalishi, which was, you know, that was my salve on the wound of not owning this album.
Oh, that wasn't on the...
That was an extra song in Canada?
Oh, yeah, that was not on Killing Machine.
Oh.
And so that blew me away getting that, and that gave me a little bit of, you know, stomping honors, at least, hey, my version has this thing on it. But I still, to this day, never felt like I really owned that album until about 20 years later I bought Killing Machine, and now I have them both.
Well, I got to agree with you on every single thing you said. You know, I definitely think British Steel is probably the band's all-time classic record. You know, the most respected, one of the most successful. But for me, Hellbent for Leather definitely trumps it. I think part of it for me also was the first Priest album that I ever got, so it's got that little special connection of being the first time. But it's definitely the best produced. As Martin said, it's the most varied. It's got the coolest album cover to date. There's just something about that record that really vibed with me then and still does. You know, you do have great songs like Running Wild, who, of course, was taken by the band Running Wild, you know, the fabulously successful German Pirates. Delivering the Goods, amazing track. It's got that whole little drum thing at the end that reminds me of Deep Purple's Flight of the Rat. But, yeah, just phenomenal production, great songs, great pacing, great variety. Just pound for pound, definitely the best Priest record.
I agree.
No question, hands down.
Yeah.
Even if British Steel is... British Steel is probably a better record, technically, sonically, everything, but there's something about this record that just resonates with me better. And, you know, the Green Manalishi, I didn't really appreciate what a great cover that was at the time, because it was really only in the last two or three years that I actually tracked down the Fleetwood Mac version, which is unbelievable in its own right. But that was such a great example of Priest taking a song that you would never think a metal band could cover and just totally making it their own and, like, just doing such an amazing job with
it. I think that with all their covers they did brilliantly.
They really did. But
except for Johnny B. Goode. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, if you listen to the the Joan Baez song, I guess that would be an equal stretch to think that a band like Priest could cover that. But
sure.
Yeah, I mean, they had a great run of covering these songs that you would have never thought could be metalized and doing a great job with them. I mean, they made that their own. You'd never listen to that song and not know it wasn't a Priest song.
Well, I love the variety of that record. I think that is just a classic metal record. Again, I think if I was to pick my favorite Priest record, it would probably be that record. And British Steel being very close, too, although Martin's going to disagree on that. We'll get into that in a bit. But Helmet for Leather.
You better not rag on British Steel.
Well, I'm going to.
Okay.
Get ready. Get ready, man.
Now, Helmet for Leather, I mean, that was awesome. I thought the production was much better, but still very clean. I mean, James Guthrie.
Oh, I love the production on that.
Yeah, I mean, James Guthrie, I thought he did a good, I mean, obviously he did like Pink Floyd stuff, The Wall, I mean, which made him famous. But the guitars still weren't, I mean, it was like mean, but it was like toned down. It didn't like breathe like the Tom Allom stuff when we got to British Steel and stuff. They weren't like walls of guitars. It was
Tom
still,
Allom or Tom Allom?
I don't know. I always thought it was Tom Allom.
I've heard it pronounced Tom Allom by Derek Oliver over in the UK. Anyway, and wait, another thing we should, no one's mentioned this yet, it also had like the first like Priest anthem, you know, Take on the World, that they did later with United, and I don't remember if they did any more after that, but
heavy metal.
That's true, that was like a heavy metal
anthem.
Full
on like anthemic track. And also, something no one else has mentioned is that record, Halford is singing different on that record.
He's going way more
gravelly and tougher.
Definitely.
He's doing not as much high-pitched stuff and just, like, summoning down to the, like, depths of his stomach and just really coming up with, like, a much gruffer, tougher vocal.
Which is all captured in the drunken pirate picture of him on the back.
Oh, I love the picture.
My favorite picture.
He looks so cool.
With the little beard there going, yeah.
The whole band looks great on the back of that. It's like the best
of that. Yeah, I love
that. Well, again, like you say, looking at vinyl records, I would just look at the back of the record and just going, this is so cool, man. I mean, look at these guys. But no, definitely, I think Halford really had a lot of confidence and his voice, and it shows. And I think on the previous album, he used, you know, the high-pitched voice a little bit too much on Stained Class and some of the others, where it was a little bit overbearing. Here, he felt he could be just as powerful or even more so without having to scream so much, especially with Delivering the Goods. And I love the fact on songs like Burning Up, that middle break in Burning Up is just awesome. It goes into kind of almost like this funk beat with, I mean, just amazing drum work from Les Binks and just, I mean, really unusual stuff for a metal band. And it was really, I think at that band, you could say, no, they definitely don't sound like Sabbath or any other metal band. They really came to their own. And you're right. They had the anthem kind of stuff as Take on the World. They did a great cover of Green Man Lisi, Evil Fantasies, another just heavy pounding tune, you know. And definitely a great record, which leads into one of my favorite live albums of all time, Unleashed in the East.
Oh, genius. Well, you know, people call it Unleashed in the Studio because it was apparently very heavily overdubbed, but...
As a lot of those albums were back then in the 70s live albums.
Yeah, I mean,
Well, what do you know about that, Martin?
I don't know a lot about it. I mean, when I've asked the guys, they've more or less convinced me that it wasn't all that heavily overdone. But I know, I've heard the stories about singing being redone because he had a cold or whatever. But yeah, you're right. It's just a great, great live album. But, you know, I'm not really going to have a lot to say about it because I'm not a big live album fan. And I don't remember spending many, 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 many hours with that record. I just don't care.
Oh, dude, when that album came out, I mean, I didn't even look at it as a live album. It was these songs, especially the old songs where we talk about Genocide and Victim of Changes, that were how the songs were meant to be.
But that's what's great, too, is that most 99% of Priest fans hadn't heard those songs prior because they were impossible to find.
True.
So what was great about that record is not only was the production fantastic, and that's how you know it was fake, because nothing could have just sounded that good if it was natural. So that was either recorded in the studio or just completely overdubbed to a degree because it sounds too good. I just think the sonics of it are great. The playing's on fire.
Absolutely.
It's got a great song selection of songs that, you know, like at least half the record no one had heard before. Amazing cover shot. It looks probably staged like Kiss Alive was. But
I was freaking out on the cover picture when I saw it in the first time I saw it in the record store.
In there. That was shot by Mick Rock in some little English town hall situation. It had nothing to do with Japan.
Interesting. You know?
Totally staged.
And then, of course, the great thing is the Japanese version, which I ended up getting later, Priest in the East. Again, you know, this is before CDs, but they had the bonus four-song EP that came with it, with Starbreaker and a couple other songs.
Were those four songs added to the reissue that Sony put out a few years ago?
Yeah, they were.
They should have been. Right.
Yeah.
I think Rock Forever might have been one of the songs, too.
Yeah, Rock Forever, Starbreaker, and Delivering the Goods, and one
of Delivering the Goods is just probably one of my top five Priest songs.
Oh, for sure, me too. But I remember hearing Victim of Changes and Genocide, that introduction to Genocide, that mid-break, when he's saying, "On the Rocks," that part, I mean, that was like probably the heaviest thing at that point I have ever heard in my life. And I just remember cranking that up, going, this is just unbelievable. And again, I hadn't heard the studio version from Sad Wings until after that.
Yeah, it was a big letdown.
Yeah, totally.
But it was four songs, right? It was Genocide, Ripper, Victim of Changes, and Tyrant, right?
I think
those were the four that, were new songs for us at the time. Freaking out the fact that I was getting to hear these songs, because it was just really impossible to find those two gold releases.
Yeah.
This was before the internet. This is before you can go on Amazon.com. This is before I could travel into Manhattan and get it. You know, I could have found them in stores in Manhattan pretty easily.
Well, didn't you get Sad Wings in America on Janus Records?
Yeah, you know what? I think you're right, Martin, just thinking back. I think it was Janus. But that it was equally as difficult
to
find as the gold stuff. Right.
But Sad Wings, it didn't seem like it was not in the stores. And I thought America kind of had Sad Wings with it.
No. I mean, I don't know about
Sad Wings, it wasn't like an import. It was hard. It was expensive.
Yeah, it was really hard to find here. I don't know where you are in L.A., Bob, but here it was impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it, but it was, you know, back then imports were like $10.99 or $11.99, whereas regular albums were like $4 or $5.99. So that was expensive for a kid to buy, and that's why I never got those two albums back then. But, yeah, definitely. Unleashed in the East, I still think one of the greatest live albums ever, regardless of how much overdubs are on there or not.
Yeah,
it's just,
I would agree with that.
Just the perfect album. All right, Britta Steele, let's have this is where the feud begins. Time to liven this up. Go for it, Martin.
Well, to me, that was the first major letdown. I mean, they changed the drummer, and the drumming, I think, on that is terrible. I think the production is bad. I don't like really anything about the production. I find it really kind of cheap and mid-rangey. You know, being shocked, you know, out of our world of Judas Priest is God with Living After Midnight, which is like their first Kiss song, and that was kind of an advanced single, that was really disappointing to us. And I think the fast songs on it are no good at all, and Stealer and Rapid Fire, I think, are just like phoned in. The Rage I like. This thing about Tom Allum and that spark of commerciality and why it's such a great album, I think, exists within Metal Gods and Grindr. To me, those are great songs, and even Breaking the Law, which has a really nice melodic hook to it, I think that song has some passion to it, but The Rage I kind of like as well, but yeah, I mean, I think half the album is a major, major letdown, and the whole thing represents a huge, huge dumbing down of the band in every single way, lyrically, musically. Like, all the riffs are simpler by half than all the riffs on the last album. Which even, you know, granted, I mean, we all love Hellbent for Leather, but I think even that is a little bit simpler an album than Sin After Sin or Stained Class. You know,
they were getting less progressive. That's not
for sure.
It's the first time that I really felt a letdown with Priest, that it wasn't going up. I mean, we loved the album. We played it to death. It was great. We loved Priest. They were becoming a people's band. I mean, that was fine. The new wave of British heavy metal was starting. That was great. But here was the first album where you thought, these guys are mortals. They aren't gods anymore.
Well, I got to disagree with most of what you said. To me, it's like right up there with Hellbent for Leather. It's probably like considered by the average metal connoisseur to be their all-time classic. I do agree with you that, you know, they took a step down drum-wise. I didn't think the new guy was as good as Les Inks. What was the guy's name again?
Dave Holland.
Dave Holland, of course, later, pedophile or whatever. But I didn't have any problem with the production. Loved the production on it. I didn't mind, actually, Living After Midnight. I thought it was a great song. I've always loved Kiss. But at the same time, I thought the rest of the record was so heavy that it didn't matter that they had this song, which was their obviously most commercial track to date. You cited a track like Rapid Fire. To me, Rapid Fire is one of the top five Priest songs. It's just one of the most brutal, heaviest tracks they've ever done. Like, I can't get enough of that track. It's my favorite track off the record. You got Metal Gods classic, Breaking the Law classic, Grindr classic. United, I didn't think it was as good as Take on the World.
No, I didn't like United at all.
Yeah, you don't have to be old. I could live without. Living After Midnight, anthemic classic song, The Rage, great song. Stealer, you know, maybe a little bit of a throwaway, but at least it was heavy as fuck. And then, yeah, I mean, just the whole record, pound for pound, it just thrills me to this day to no end.
Yeah, I totally side with you, Monty, on that one. I mean, when that came out, you got to remember, that was 1980. That was before the term metal became what it is known today. And that, I think, was the defining metal record. Although Hellbent for Leather, I think, was, in a way, the ultimate at its time. I think British Steel took it a step further. And that was always a great thing about Judas Priest. They never really made the same record twice until after British Steel. But when that album came out, I mean, they took it to a new level. You listen to the production at that time. Dude, walls of guitar sound. I mean, yes, of course, Dave Holland wasn't near as technically good as, say, a Les Binks or a Simon Phillips, but he was he came from the John Bonham School, that 4/4 time, and just that drum sound and guitar sound hadn't been heard again. I remember when I first got that record, when it first came out, I put it on. Of course, Breaking the Law was the opening song on the vinyl version. That song I didn't care about.
Rapid Fire, I think. I'm looking on Amazon right now.
When the vinyl came out in America on CBS, Breaking the Law was the opening, and that was definitely geared toward. Yeah, and then Rapid Fire followed that, which I love that. I agree, Monty. I mean, that song, I just love the bit. It just comes across like a freight train, and Metal God
pounding the world.
Yeah, like, and you know what's funny was when they did it live with Ripper Owens, they added that little chorus.
Yeah, they added it.
Rapid Fire or whatever, but all their other stuff before, especially on Hellbent for Leather, it was so filled with drum riffs and, you know, different little things here and there, or vocal things. This was kind of empty. I agree with it. It was like, it just let the guitars, I've never heard just the guitars just pound like that, and it just really breathed. And I remember first hearing it thinking, wow, this sounds like a rough mix or something. This can't be right, you know. But then after listening to it, especially Metal Gods, I remember when my parents would leave, I would just crank that up. The ending to that song was just so fucking heavy with the whips coming down.
Halford got his moniker from that, the Metal God.
Exactly.
You know, this record was like, their Metallica Black album, the album where they matured, where they reached a bigger audience, but they didn't sell out. And, you know, maybe at the time people thought they did, but now you can see they didn't. The same way people thought the Metallica Black album was a big sellout at the time. So, you know, Hellbent was the And Justice for All, but
I don't know how you
was the Black album.
I don't know how you could say that this isn't where they sold out. Because
they didn't sell out.
You don't have to be old to be wise on it. It had Living After Midnight on it, Breaking the Law on it.
Yeah, but
those two songs. But wait, Living After Midnight was kind of a fun, okay, that was a commercial song, but back then you expected that from bands to throw in a couple songs once they kind of made it, but the other songs, I think, were heavier, and I like You Don't Have to Be Old to Be Wise. I think the lyrics on that were great, and I think it was just so catchy, and I love his vocal phrasing on that.
Oh, I know, but
he sounds so confident and got a little bit of a commercial hook to it, but that's what I thought made Priest so great, but still, the pounding production was heavy as hell, dude. It
and,
was
you know, I got a rag on Rapid Fire because I just picture that as this, you know, you can see the guitarist's hands moving. You can see him coasting, phoning it in. It's almost like Ace of Spades is not.
Yeah, but no one had done that to that time. You got to remember, this came out in 1980. You didn't hear these walls of guitars, just an open chord just going and resonating. You never really heard that before.
That's the heaviest track Priest ever done in my book.
Ah, to me, it doesn't even sound heavy. I picture a guitarist strumming away.
Wait, what about the part, the B section where, or I guess the bridge, you know?
Hammering. That's pretty cool.
And the vocals are heavy, too.
Again, you've got not really heavy production, and you've also got a drummer that's going, you know, standard hardcore punk.
Well, I agree on the drummer.
Drives me crazy.
He didn't add anything to it, put it that way, but he got the job.
But I think that was meant to be. I mean, if you listen to, like, the first Montrose album or the early Zeppelin albums, it was just straightforward drumming, but solid as fuck. I think that's what they were going for. I mean, this ushered in the new wave of British heavy metal. I mean, this is what British heavy metal is. I think that was like a defining round album.
And look at someone like Phil Rudd from AC/DC. The guy says no frills as they get. He just holds the beat. Very few frills, but he gets the job done. But also, Martin, what about on Hellbent for Leather? You had songs like Evening Star and Before the Dawn that are like as mellow as commercials, that are pretty damn commercial.
There are two songs. They're short, and it's a 9 or 10 track album. And basically, that's fine. I like that for variety. I mean, they were short, and Evening Star you can match up against You Don't Have to Be Old or Living After Midnight. But even that song has just a little more class to it. I mean, it's not a sellout to kids kind of thing. And that's what I think of most of British Steel is.
Dude, I think most Priest fans love Living After Midnight.
Oh, yeah, I know. So do I. I mean, I like it, too.
I hated it when it came out, but after hearing it now, I'm going, wow, this is catchy commercial metal song.
And that song's got a ton of swagger, too. Living After Midnight's about as swaggery as Judas Priest ever got.
Yeah. And I used to argue with people that Helmet for Leather, easily by far the best Priest album, and all my friends would say, British Steel, British Steel. But now I kind of agree with them. I could see how British Steel really was the album that really not only broke Priest, but really defined the metal sound.
Okay.
So there you go.
We're going to hang up. Well, when we hang up, you got to go crank Rapid Fire.
Yeah. That's an album you really have to crank up to enjoy. Okay, now we could get into it. Point of Entry.
Well, again, okay.
Wait,
so
wait,
here,
Screaming for Vengeance next?
No,
Point of Entry next.
Point of Entry.
And, oh, God, I got to polish up here.
I remember now.
Point of Entry, 1981, 1 year after British
Steel. I remember an advanced single, again, like Living After Midnight, and this time it was, oh, what was it?
Heading Out to the Highway?
No, it was a mellower one than that. Don't Go, maybe? Might have been Don't Go.
I got to tell you that, when I saw that video for Don't Go, that confirmed Rob Halford's gayness.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, I had heard stories about Halford. I always argued, you know, as a kid, you know, people would say, oh, Unleashed in These, that's how all the gay people look in Santa Monica Boulevard. I go, no, man, that's the heavy metal look. And then after Don't Go came out, with him and his little Freddie Mercury mustache, it was like, all right, yeah, Halford's gay. I mean, you can't argue it at that point after seeing that video, which is cool. It didn't change anything. It was just the fact that, okay, yeah, you're right, he's gay.
I'm going to be blasphemous here, but, I mean, I remember at the time, definitely, I was horrified. It was not that great an album. It was a big disappointment after British Steel, which was a little disappointment to me after Hellbent for Leather. But now I like Point of Entry more than British Steel. I mean, I find more to enjoy on that album. I think the production's a little bit richer. I love the subtle melodic poppy hooks on it. I think Heading Out to the Highway is every bit as good as Breaking the Law.
There's
more stuff on there that I'm not sick of. Now, that's no reason to dislike an album. I mean, that's why we all rag on Zeppelin 4, even though it's a great album. But I just find more value, you know, if I revisit any of these old albums of that time, that's one that I can go back to and hear some things and enjoy again. But yes, at the time it was definitely poppier. It sold less. You know, KK or Glenn can be a little bit extreme. I mean, I always take him sort of to task when he says, "Oh, it was the most progressive album of all time at that time." I love that quote that he said.
Yeah, all bands always say it's
yeah.
obvious.
Yeah,
you know,
but I mean,
then,
really,
they're ragging on the same record when the next one comes out.
Yeah,
all the advanced press.
But it was, you know, it was definitely a disappointment. And I remember as a kid. Well, actually, at that point, I would have been 18 or something like that. But at that time, I remember thinking, yes, they've lost it. They've sold out yet again, because they had already sold out, in my mind, once, big time, with British Steel. I mean, here was even actually less of a drop in selling out as gradations go. But I really had no time for that album, not a lot of value put into that album, not a lot of time put into it at the time. Monty?
Well, I agree. When it first came out, I was a little disappointed, but I still really liked it. I didn't hate the record, you know. Instead of giving it a 10, I would kind of give it an 8. So I was pretty kind to the record at the time, but I do know what you're saying, Martin, in terms of, like, obviously we're adults now, we hear things in a more mature way, so it doesn't surprise me that that album is held up for you, that you probably appreciate it more than you did back then. But again, you know, just to say that that record is better than Bird of Steel, that requires a beating. You know, it's a few good tracks. Heading Out to the Highway, I really like. Hot Rockin' was like the heavy track on the record at the time. And Solar Angels, cool track. I believe they opened their show with Solar Angels.
Yeah, they did.
They did Desert Plains. I saw that tour at the Palladium here in New York. And so, I don't know. Somehow I have a feeling that I probably liked that record better at the time than I would right now. I haven't played that record in many years, but I bet you I'd like it less than I did back when I was a kid. I was pretty forgiving back then for some reason. I didn't mind the record. As I said, I gave it like an 8 at the time.
Yeah, I'm...
But it was definitely their worst album to date. It was like the first time they'd made a pretty obvious misstep.
Yeah, it was definitely a disappointment. I remember when that album first came out, and I went out to the... I remember it came out in England before then, on import.
Yeah, with that horrible cover. Not that the U.S. cover was much better. Which cover did you guys have in Canada, Martin?
Same as the U.S.
Looks like film, a roll of film.
It's old computer paper.
Right.
Terrible.
But, that was definitely a disappointment. Yeah, heading out to the highway, I thought was, you know, that was a good rockin' song. I mean, again, when I first heard it, I was still a huge Priest fan, but I actually listened to it the other day, kind of get caught up on some of the albums I hadn't listened to in so long, and I could hear that, oh man, they were just totally trying to sell out to the American radio market on that one. I mean, I listened to the songs You Say Yes, All the Way, Turning Circles, Don't Go. I mean, it was filled with crap songs on it. You know, you could say Breaking the Law, but even Breaking the Law was kind of a catchy tune and heavy rhythms on it.
Well, my only regret.
But these songs were just total sellout songs. I like Desert Plains. I like Solar Angels. But for the most part, the band was clearly trying to sell to the American market at that point. Although at the time, I still liked it. I still listened to it. But listening to it now, nah.
Yeah, but you know what? But if we didn't have that record, we wouldn't have had Screaming for Vengeance. So.
Which I think is a great record. Well, let's lead it to that. Yeah. You want to start that out, Martin? Screaming for Vengeance, 1982.
I guess that was a return to form of sorts. But again, you know, a little bit of uneasiness in that, okay, now we're getting the yellow and the cartoony machine metallion kind of guys. But I remember, you know, the one side of the album, amazing. We thought, you know, Priest was back. These are great killer tracks. I thought maybe the production was better than British Steel, not as organic as Point of Entry, but kind of maybe a little more muscular than Point of Entry in some way, obviously a little more modern. Great, great anthems on the one side, but then the second side, after, you know, a really heavy, raging title track that was quite good, I figure, you know, they finished the entire side off with Kiss songs. And You Got Another Thing Coming, I didn't think was a very good song.
I still don't. That's like a big Priest hit that I'm not really into.
When I heard that, yeah. I thought it was a cool tune because it kind of reminded me actually of like Thin Lizzy. It had that kind of tribal Indian drum beat, and I thought it was a very unique song and a very catchy song. Yeah, I mean, now I'm sick to death of it. But when it first came out, I thought, you know, this is kind of cool. I liked it.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I just felt a big letdown with that side. Although, you know, obviously Priest was totally back. This was a way heavier album than the last one. Electric Eyes, just an amazing song.
Yeah,
Riding on the Wind, amazing song. You know,
Bloodstone.
Yeah,
those three songs just back to back.
The first four tracks, if you include the Hellion, and then of course Screaming for Vengeance. So. In my book, with those four songs on the record, like, I can forgive all the rest because
I feel the same way there.
You get a positive feeling. It's the same way when I'm doing records these days, I tend to front load them. You know, if I'm doing a 12-track record, I'll put the best songs up top, even if the end of the record sucks, because I feel if you hook kids at the beginning, they have a favorable vibe of the record, regardless of what happens, even if it falls apart at the end, and that's the perfect example of that.
I thought, you know, Judas Priest wrote good commercial songs on their own. I hated the fact that they hired this Bob Halligan or whoever it was to write these purposely produced commercial radio anthems, and still they didn't get much. What was it, Pain and Pleasure, and what was the other song?
Chains.
And they weren't even the hits on that record. Everyone hated them, and I thought it was just a real disappointment that the band would hire a songwriter that they didn't need. But I think that was more toward the record company. Obviously, Priest had made a name for themselves. You know, they had gotten some radio success. They were selling, you know, gold and maybe even platinum records at the time. I don't know. But production-wise, Tom Allen just did a brilliant job. I mean, that snare drum, it wasn't like the synthetic bullshit of, you know, these Mutt Lang, Def Leppard kind of production. It just had this crisp bite to it, and the guitars were just monstrous. And like you said, the introduction to Hellion that leads into Electric Eye, I thought it was a great song. Lyrically, kind of futuristic, which really holds true today. If you read the lyrics, I mean, about like cameras being everywhere, following you around. I mean, I thought it was just really brilliant, very progressive on their part.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, were you still going at it there, Monty?
No. I'm chomping at the bit to talk about the Fenders now. Let me take the lead on this because...
Okay, go for it.
A lot, you know, it's hard not to be influenced by some of what Martin says. So I have no idea, Martin. I haven't read your reviews and your books on these, so I have no idea where you're going to stand on this record. So I'm just curious to see if you're going to agree. But to me, the Fenders was just like kind of Screaming for Vengeance Part 2, similar cover, similar vibe, similar production. And although, you know, at the time, I kind of had moved on from Priest at that point because I was starting to discover Tigers of Pantang and Accept and getting into the really heavy stuff. So at that point, I kind of left Priest behind, and I didn't really give Defenders a fair shot at the time because I was into heavier stuff. But, you know, a few years later, that situation resurrected itself, you know, and I kind of, like, started getting back into Priest again. And then when I went back and listened to that record, I was pretty surprised. I don't think it's got, you know, pound for pound, the classics, those like four or five classics that we talked about in Screaming. But I think overall it's a more solid record. It's less up and down and doesn't really have those embarrassing moments that Screaming for Vengeance had. So I'm going to predict, Martin, that you're going to prefer that record and think it was, you know, a step back in the right direction. Am I wrong?
Well, let's see. First of all, I agree with everything you said, pretty much. And I don't know. I mean, better record or not, it's hard to say. You're right. I mean, it is more even. I mean, those two are so evenly matched for me because, yes, I mean, I don't feel as passionate about each and every song on the second one as those four that you mentioned on the previous one. But again, when you add it all up, it adds up to the same kind of, you know, pretty cool, heavy album. Again, the production is going a little bit downhill. It's definitely a lot more of that 80s stuff, I think, was added to the production. And I agree. I mean, I remember moving on to a lot of different bands, and Priest are just the embarrassing uncle in the up in the attic kind of thing. And here comes another Priest album, and okay, that's great. I remember getting into all those other bands, but I don't remember picturing them as heavier than Priest, and here Priest was coming back with a slightly heavier album. I suppose there were heavier bands. There was Metallica and Anthrax and stuff, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, 84.
But yeah, I mean, there were lots and lots and lots of bands to chew on by that point. I mean, really, Iron Maiden was kicking their ass at that point.
Definitely, Maiden, Saxon, Diamond Head. I mean, the new version of metal was really breaking. And even though I still love Priest and I was still a big Priest fan, you know, there was so much new, refreshing music coming out at that point. So I kind of put down the back burner. But I'm like Monty. I came back and listened to that record. And the thing about that album, it was definitely a follow-up to Screaming for Vengeance.
Yeah,
and it was one of their only albums at that point that they didn't really leap into some new territory. I mean, I think every album was so far in advance different. This, I think they kind of kept the same formula. Good songs, though. Actually, they weren't bad songs. Love Bites, Eat Me Alive, they were good commercial songs, but heavy at the same time.
And I think Free Will Burnings definitely can hold its own with the quartet of classics.
I thought the lyrics were kind of stupid, though.
I disagree there. I thought that song was really weak, and I remember as an advanced single. You know, but what bothered me as a drummer is that I just hated the fact that every single fast song was do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know? Everything was the same thing. And then Tom Allen puts his Kiss of Death on top of it. And I just felt here was an advanced single, and here we are trying to be heavier than Thou and heavier than everything else. And I think that song really falls on its face compared to some of the, you know, lesser sung songs on the album.
And I thought Free Will Burning was just a poor version of Screaming for Vengeance.
You know what Screaming has, which is...
on the minority on that one.
Yeah. You know what Screamin' has, which is really neat that we didn't mention? You guys remember that amazing, cool little break in that song where it's almost like KK or Glenn, I don't know who it is, but they're rising to a level of almost like a Brian May in that riff. That break.
Right, right, right.
Amazing, amazing, cool break. I thought literally that is the high point of that whole album.
Right, yeah. Now that is a crushing solo.
Cool.
But now, as far as Ram It Down goes, can we just skip it?
Yeah.
Actually, we're at Turbo now. That's one we should skip, but we should talk. We got to talk about Turbo.
I keep getting this,
1986.
I keep getting my order here really mixed up. This is embarrassing. I'll start with Turbo as well. I think Turbo was a record that at the time was just very maligned. Is that the right word? Maligned?
Yeah.
And I think it's a record that was a little bit ahead of its time. I think history has been kind to that record because I think a lot of people that hated that record at the beginning have come to appreciate it now, especially as they've gotten older. You know, it might have been a different record for Priest, but I thought the song Turbo, I thought was fantastic.
Turbo
and I think it's some of the most mature songwriting and some of the best songs they've written, maybe not on metal terms, but just the level of songwriting and playing and everything on that record was fantastic. It just really wasn't much of a Priest record. I thought it was a great record that just wasn't a great Priest record. But looking back, I'm totally down with that record.
Wow.
Yeah, I like it. I dig it.
Martin?
Well, you know, I find myself being more and more of a Priest fan, and surprising myself because I actually do quite like British Steel and Point of Entry and Turbo. I find value in all these records. I really do like them, and I totally agree with Monty. There's so much cool, subtle textures all over it. Great songwriting. Really neat little technological ideas on it. The production is better than probably both of the previous two. in a certain way. And yeah, Turbo Lover's great. I mean, what a tasteful solo on that. It does have a few, you know, clunkers like Parental Guidance.
I love Parental Guidance. We don't
yeah, I don't know.
No. Yeah. Parental Guidance here.
Yeah, just way too commercial kind of thing.
Oh,
but,
totally.
You know, the funny thing that signals that everybody's going to hate it is a visual off the bat, because it has those washed out primary colors compared to the previous two for the cover. I mean, even the cover is uglier than the previous two.
I'm trying to picture that. Had like the dark, like black and white.
Yeah, with a hand on the stick shift. Kind
but it
of
was
kind of
like a pale blue and a white.
Yeah.
And
well, it was the same artist, right? That did the last couple of. I'm going to disagree with you both, man. I mean, that was just a total lame sellout of an album. I thought at the time, listening back to it now, I appreciate it more. I remember at the time just hating it, you know, because at that point I was like totally evolved in the new wave of British heavy metal. And at the time, I just lost interest in Priest. But listening back on it, I mean, Turbo Lover and Locked In, the first two records, I thought were good songs. Very well written, even though the synthesizer, and I hated the Mutt Lang kind of drum, paper bag drum snare sound, but they were good songs. But the other albums, the other songs, Parental Guidance and Rock You All Around the World, I mean, they were just, you know, traditional, lame, commercial pop songs, I thought.
You know what's a couple of great songs on that are Hot for Love and Reckless. You know, especially Reckless. Wow, what a passionate sort of, you know, melodic sequence. It reminds you of the magic of those changes in Breaking the Law, almost. And had nothing.
I gotta go back and hear that.
You know, by the way, I forgot to mention this about Breaking the Law. I love that song, but the one thing that, like, really stopped that song from being an ultimate classic for me is the fact that there's no solo in it.
Hmm. I kind of like that.
It's got the siren thing, and then you just want a little bit more. It's just a little too stripped down.
I thought it was cool because it was kind of punk in a way. It was like pop punk. Should we move on to, I guess, the Priest Live album, 1987? We'll briefly touch on that.
Well, I was already, like, out of Priest at that point. I was, like, into my Sax and Riot and Anvil. And
right.
So I definitely did not get that at all when it came out, and only got it years later. And it's not Unleashed in the East. That's all I'm saying.
That was a horrible live album, and one of the worst. I mean, I've done on their worst tour, the Turbo Tour, I think, the band. Not only song-wise, but I think the band lost some momentum there. And, again, just going for the commercial radio and MTV. What's your view, Martin?
Well, and the album cover was horrible. I mean, my view is that I always compare it to Exit Stage Left versus All the World's a Stage, or any of those follow-up live albums. It's the bloated stadium phoned-in tour kind of thing. It's not the greatest songs, but it's kind of cool, you know, when you're a worn-out Priest fan who's played everything to death, to go back and play those songs and go, my God, I mean, here's like, whatever, 3, 4, 5 Turbo songs or whatever, or Defender songs. I mean,
right.
it is kind of cool to actually be able to own live versions of some of that stuff.
Right. And also to hear them play the old classics when they were in that, like, very commercial-minded...
Well, they didn't really play too many old classics on that record. I don't think there's anything before Fritter Steel.
To hear them playing those old songs when they were in that mode that they were on in Turbo. And
right.
Also, there was a DVD from that. There was a DVD from that, and they're wearing, like, you know, those really, like, lame-looking clothes.
Ram It Down, which we'll get into.
There's nothing good to say. There's just nothing
well,
even
then,
said about that.
Let's
record.
Say that, because I agree. There's nothing good to say. I think it was the worst cover they could have done, Johnny
I
B. Good.
I didn't mind the cover. Oh, no, I didn't mind the album cover itself. You know?
No, I meant the cover of Johnny B. Good, which was that movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
Who was that? Michael Anthony Hall or some cheesy football movie? But when you talk about the songs like bands doing speed metal just to be fast with the lame drumming, Ram It Down was just kind of like, all right, well, let's kick this album off with a semi-thrash metal song just to get our old listeners back. I think that was the only purpose of putting that song on.
Yeah, show those kids how relevant we are, which really just graphically shows how irrelevant they are.
Yeah.
I mean, thrash is already mature. Death metal is getting there. I mean, it's...
Yeah, this is 1988,
metal.
So this is...
Yeah, I mean, death metal is showing up, and Slayer's been around for a while, and, you know, yeah, it was just a phoned-in album with another tired Tom Allen production, you know, what is that, 3, 4, 5 in a row or whatever. And yeah, just the whole idea was we are not doing anything new here. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're being heavier than the last album, Whoopie-Doo.
I thought they would think it was going to be like a comeback to the heaviness, but it just fell way short. Anyway, that leads us to Painkiller, 1990.
What a reinvention that was. That's probably the heaviest Priest record. I mean, that's a pretty modern-sounding record. You could tell the band was starting to be influenced by some of the heavier bands that were around at the time. Painkiller is like one of the all-time classics.
Definitely.
Total. I mean, that was like, in my opinion, like one of the greatest comebacks of all time. Pulling it up now on Amazon just so I can cite specific songs because I haven't played that record in a while.
And now that was Chris Zangaridis that produced that. A lot of people argue saying that was such a synthetic production, and I love the production on that. I thought, you know, like you said, the Tom Allen production was getting kind of tired and old. I thought the production was great. You agree, Monty?
Yes. And I just thought it was Scott Travis coming to the band. It was the first time in many years that they had like a fucking killer drummer. Looking at the track listing here, I haven't played this record in years, but I'm recognizing tracks like Painkiller and Nightcrawl and Metal Meltdown, but honestly, like, I have no idea what Hell Patrol or Guns Blazing or Leather Rebel even
sound like. They were kind of throwaways. Touch of Evil, the intro to that was awesome.
But, you know, I mean, Painkiller was just such a great song itself. It just kind of set the table. It made you want to like the rest of it, and you did like the rest of it just because you were so well set up to like it. So, you know, I definitely wouldn't put it up there with, you know, any of the classics, but I thought it was a big return to form for them at the time. And, you know, in my opinion, the last great thing the band has done.
I agree. What about you, Martin?
I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, I did this book a few years back, the Top 500 Heavy Metal Albums of All Time, where a huge poll was taken, and this album came in super, super high. It was unbelievable. I think when it comes to young kids, they love this album.
Sure.
They think this is just a great classic album. And definitely it was a return to form. It had great production, a lot of good layering, a lot of thought put into it. The thing that kind of left me a little bit cold is that the lyrics are just like this kiddie metal, look how heavy we are, you know, gleaming monsters everywhere kind of thing.
I agree there. I thought the lyrics at that time got a little bit old.
Yeah, that kind of bothered me, but, you know, it is a good heavy album, obviously way better than Ram It Down, but, I mean, honestly, at the time, I don't even know if I liked it more than anything before it, excluding Ram It Down. I mean, at that point, there was so much metal to choose from, so much non-metal to choose from. I was still in my somewhat drifted, moved on mode. Here comes the new Priest album. Cool. I'm kind of into it, but I don't really invest a whole lot of energy into it. And I thought it was hilarious, Monty, when you mentioned, you know, you're looking at the song titles, and, I mean, I'm drawing a blank with half these song titles.
Yeah.
I mean, it really just...
It didn't have a lot of big songs, apart from Painkiller.
Yeah, the sides...
Nightcrawler, maybe.
They fade on, and you look at all these, like, Manowar titles, and you go, whatever. Yeah. You know?
Well, I think at that point, there were so many great metal bands that were coming out. We're talking 1990 was when, you know, I mean, that was like the whole influx of thrash metal and all that. So there were so many bands that have surpassed Judas Priest as far as speed and heaviness and whatever you want to say. And I think they did try too hard lyrically to say, oh, we're metal, we're heavy, and adding these kind of, like you say, kiddish kind of lyrics. But I think it was definitely a strong comeback record and something they needed to do after the Turbo and the Ram It Down and just to claim their reign in heavy metal supremacy. I mean, absolutely, Scott Travis added a lot. I mean, listen to the intro to Painkiller. I mean, it's like that just kicks the album off. And
yeah,
like,
totally.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great album, song per song, but it was definitely Priest's best record since, I think, Defenders. Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. What was the next one after that? Was it Demolition?
Jugulator first.
Oh, damn. See, there goes my...
Halford did the Fight projects, and then he did two... then Jugulator came out just after Fight, yeah.
I think then two, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what's going to sound weird is I wasn't really following Priest at the time, so I don't own Jugulator or Demolition to this day.
Right.
But I've heard songs here and there, and I know this is going to sound blasphemous, but, you know, is there such a thing as something being too metal? Like, those records just, it's like Priest just trying to be something they're not. They're trying so hard to kind of do what Halford did by joining Fight. They're just so hard trying to modernize their sound and compete with, like, the badass tough kids of the day that...
Totally.
It's almost like too metal. It just doesn't feel right for Priest. I mean, I know it sounds crazy to say something's too heavy.
Tried too hard, you're right, and
it just
doesn't work.
It doesn't really fit them. They don't really sound great trying to be a thrash band or be a Pantera.
I think they were being too influenced by the new sounds that were coming out. You mentioned Pantera and all these newer bands. I think they're figuring, oh, we have to be like this to compete. It just doesn't sound like it was true to them. I mean, it just basically the songs just weren't that good. I mean, they had a few good riffs. I love the opening riff to a Burn in Hell, and I think that's real powerful in the way Ripper starts that out. Bloodstain was fairly good, but apart from that, I don't recall any of the songs.
I think Ripper's the best thing about those records for me is just listening to Ripper because I'm a big fan of his vocals. So
in Ripper's case, I thought he did a great job, and it has nothing to do with the vocals. It's just that the songs just weren't that good on it. And particularly on Going Into Demolition, I think I've heard that record maybe once.
Yeah, I don't own either one, and I don't really.
Yeah, and that was just totally. What's your views on these two? We'll kind of blend these two together, Martin.
They totally blend together for me. And I agree. I love Ripper as a frontman, as a singer, but I just find it baffling that after this search that took years and years or whatever, and I remember reading, you know, numbers of, 5,000 tapes we went through and all this. Well, so you do all that and you don't get a guy who is a writer, or you don't get a guy that you want to ask to write, because basically that's kind of what happened. I mean, these albums were written without your lead singer helping write them. You know, I mean, he was in there, but he kind of probably felt like he had to be a bit of a yes man and basically not rock the boat.
Those two albums also go to show you how important Rob Halford's writing contributions were, because it's pretty obvious Halford just didn't just write lyrics, he wrote music as well, because at the time that they were doing these records, Halford put out the Resurrection record, which to me...
Brilliant record,
is a fucking amazing record. To me, I'll take that over Painkiller. Like, to me, that's like the best thing that Priest has ever
done. I think both the Halford records, Resurrection and...
Crucible.
I wasn't a big Crucible fan, but
I like
Resurrection
better.
Right up there with, like, Screaming for Vengeance and British Steel. And
no, I agree. Although I thought
record.
The 2 was kind of a mistake, and the Fight records had some moments, but definitely the Halford solo records were classic.
Halford definitely, like, pissed on them with his records. His career was, like, way better than theirs at that point.
Well, and the parallel is Bruce Dickinson with the amazing Chemical Wedding, and Accident of Birth was pretty good, and Tyranny of Souls was pretty good, too.
It's a total parallel when they got Blaze Bailey as when Priest got Ripper.
Exactly, it's almost comical. Yeah. But, I mean, the thing is, you know, Roy Z is a common factor there as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously, Resurrection's a great record, and I love it and all that, but it is a little bit of a safe record in saying, let's just give the fans exactly what they want, kind of thing. And
yeah,
same with
what nothing
Bruce
wrong with
did.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, and you're right. I'll take it over Painkiller and half the Priest records, practically.
Monty, give it to us.
Wait, are you stopping? You're not taping this, right?
No, I am taping it. Of course.
Oh, come on. I can't do it on the air.
Come on, man.
No, I'll be embarrassed. We'll do it when we afterwards.
All right.
I can go pretty high. I can do King Diamond and Rob Halford.
Really? Come on, do it on tape. All right,
no,
this is one
I can't.
Day.
I can't. And I can't do it on Commando. It'll suck.
All right. Well, we could do it after the interview. Let's briefly touch up on Angel of Retribution. That came out, of course, in 2006.
That's a personal one for me, because Roadrunner was actually in the bidding for that record. We were offering a shitload of money to get that record. So, you know, I definitely was very anxious to see what it sounded like. I love the song Angel of Retribution.
Judas Rising.
The song Judas Rising,
yeah.
I think, is a classic. I like Deal with the Devil. There's a few other songs I like, but overall...
I agree, the first two songs I thought were great. And
then it just kind of goes downhill. And honestly, I think Roy Z is an incredible producer, and he's really great with songs, but I don't think he's got the chops as an engineer or whoever he uses as an engineer. I just think the production and the mix on that record is a huge, huge letdown. It just sounds cheap and small and muddy. Like, I don't think it was Roy's production. I just think it, or even the tones. I just think the way that record was mixed really didn't do it justice. So that certainly didn't help things. But sonics aside, I just didn't think the songs were quite as great as they needed to be. You know, I was wishing that, you know, Resurrection would have been that. To me, Resurrection should have been the record Priest made as Angel of Retribution. So, yeah, pretty big letdown. And I know, Martin, you're big on production, so I'm sure you're going to have the same issues.
I totally agree with you. Although, one thing I don't agree with is I don't like Judas Rising and the fact that, which song is it? Is it Demonizer later that sounds exactly the same way and has the same sort of faults? I mean, my favorite songs on there, I thought Revolution was a really brave, different kind of
that was kind of cool.
Interestingly
that
produced
was
song,
cool, yeah.
But I really like Worth Fighting For and Hell Rider.
Hell Rider is a good one. Definitely.
Yeah, I thought it had, and Loch Ness, of course, is a complete embarrassment. Everybody,
I don't think that's so bad. I think it's terrible.
But, I think it's cheesy.
But you know, that album definitely has its moments. It's promising. It's definitely got some value to it. But yeah, something about the production. You throw it on, and the badness of the production doesn't leap out at you, almost like Sad Wings in a way. But eventually you come away saying, something just sounds a little shoddy about this.
When I first heard it, you know, I got a track or two on the internet, and I figured, it was an advanced thing. It was leaking. It wasn't mastered, if it was a rough or something. And then when I got the final CD, it really didn't sound all that different. You know, I'll tell you right now, had Priest signed here, I would have not let that out. I would have pressured them to, like, get a Colin Richardson. Imagine what Colin Richardson, a guy like that, could do with that record, how amazing it would have sounded.
Yeah.
I think you're right. It's in the mix, because I thought Roy's previous works with the Bruce Dickinson and the Rod Halford solo record sounded much better.
Oh, great.
That he produced. And that it did kind of shock me when I heard this record. I thought the production was not near as good as it could have been. I don't know. That album just, to me, it just sounded rushed. It sounded like, okay, we got Rod Halford back in the band. Let's hurry up and write some songs and put them out.
It didn't sound like the big comeback they needed to make. It definitely.
It could have been a huge comeback. It could have been like Payne Keller times 10. Like you said, Rob has so much potential with his solo stuff, and I think that they could have made a great comeback record given the time. I don't know if it was a record label that pushed them just for, you know, their financial benefit, just to let's get the record out and going, you know, kind of thing.
Honestly, if Resurrection would have been the record they came back with, it would have been hailed as a fucking masterpiece. It would have satisfied everyone completely and thoroughly.
For sure.
Well, before we close, let's kind of give your views on what you think about No One Has Heard This Nostradamus Yet, or have you heard?
I haven't heard anything.
Well, I didn't know. The idea of concept albums always scares me because so many of them are terrible, so yeah. It really doesn't sound like a good thing in practice, but somehow, I don't know, they seem to be taking their time on it. Maybe they learned from Angel of Retribution. I have a feeling it might be pretty damn good, but who knows?
Yeah.
It'll be interesting.
And imagine
for sure.
If it's a double. I mean, to be confronted with a Priest double album, I mean, how is that going to kind of...
Yeah, that's
the
never
salt
happened.
Shaker. That's kind of a weird thing. So you're going to be looking all over the place. You're going to find lots of great songs, and then you know some not so great songs, and you're wondering, well, I guess this is enough. I mean, I guess this is really really cool. But this whole idea of Nostradamus, you know, it reminds me a little bit about what Corthon from Bathory told me one time. You know, like you think, oh, big evil black metal guy, right? And you know, he says, once you understand or realize that it's all bullshit, like none of this is even real, it just becomes laughable kind of thing. And there's a little bit of that to this whole idea of Nostradamus. I mean, it's like, well, could the guy really tell the future? If not, what are we left with for a story here?
Right. Well, and what we also have to wonder about this record is what's Halford going to sound like? Because the last thing I got from Priest was that DVD, the live DVD, I forgot the name of it, with the great cool cover, the bluish color.
I think that was toward the end of the tour, because when I saw Halford live here on the West Coast, he sounded great.
Well, I don't know. It's not like he sounded bad on it, but I noticed that he, like a lot of the high stuff, he was like singing in a lower key because he couldn't hit it.
What a great conversation that was. Many thanks to the great Monty Connor and the great Martin Popoff for that incredible debate on Judas Priest. We had so much fun doing that we're planning another great debate on the entire Deep Purple catalog. So that will be in a future podcast. I'll keep you posted on that. Our next episode is going to feature another great three-way conversation with myself, Stefan Shirazi, the author of the great Metallica book, So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly, and also the editor for the Metallica Fan Club magazine. He is going to be joining us along with John Cornerens, an old-time metal fan and one of Lars's best friends when he first came over to the States. So it's going to be a great, great three-way conversation. That should be coming up next. Once again, I want to thank you all for tuning into the Shockwaves Hard Radio podcast. Like to get your opinions on the show, so email me, shockwaves@hardradio.com. You can also check us out on MySpace. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next time.